Garrett Greider is a young guy living in Weston, Missouri. He majored in ag at Truman State University, and in a new documentary called Farmers for America, you can see him doing chores on Green Dirt Farm. He's trudging through fields, hosing down a barn, and bottle-feeding lambs. But Garrett's real dream is to start his own pig farm.
I kind of thought about some different names for a farm, and the one I kind of like is Fangoso Farm, which is Spanish, and Fangoso means muddy.
When he started renting a house across the gravel road from Green Dirt Farm, Garrett's dream started looking like it might become a reality. The house sat on 200 acres, and he got to talking to the landlord about his idea. They were down to the nitty-gritty.
Everything from infrastructure down to, you know, management, to what feeds I would use, to how I'd market my products, everything. I've thought about everything.
And then the owner of the land died.
The family put up the land for sale, and I thought I was going to have a chance, and then came the price. And land around here sells for about $10,000 an acre. Got to keep in mind I'm competing with retired lawyers, retired doctors, other farmers, big farmers that have lots of money. They said whoever bought it will just tear that house down and build a new house. Probably tear down, maybe tear down the barn. Kind of too bad, really. So, because it could have been a great spot for someone to start a small farm, but not going to happen, I don't think.
Since the making of the documentary, Garrett has had to stop farming altogether. He's working full-time delivering mail. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be hearing about the challenges facing young farmers with the filmmaker and two local farmers, including Garrett. We'll start with the filmmaker, Graham Merriweather. If you had to sum up the idea behind Farmers for America, what would it be?
Hi, Gina. Well, I would say that the idea is, first of all, in America, I think a lot of us, we eat our meals from drive-through windows. We're often thinking about the stresses or the joys of life, and we're not really reflecting on the fact that a family dedicates their lives to feeding us. So the first thing we're looking to do with this film is to celebrate America's farmers. And then the next thing I would say is that we're in an unprecedented moment in American agricultural history. The average age of the U.S. farmer is 60 years old. And unless we're able to inspire and support a new generation of farmers, we're going to be importing most of our food in 20 years.
I feel like there might be just a visceral reaction to this question, but what would be the problem with that?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that I believe that every nation should be able to feed itself. Anytime the nation is dependent upon another nation for its food, that puts that country in a precarious position, because if the political climate changes, suddenly you might be in a situation in which the food gets shut off.
Well, that seems like just a basic kind of very American principle in a way, the self-reliance and all of that.
Absolutely. I mean, we're a nation of farmers, and since our inception, we've seen the number of farmers decline and decline and decline and decline. And we're at the point now where we're looking at about 1% of the American population as farmers. And if you think about it, 1% of the population holding up 99% of the population is not a super sustainable system. We need to get more people, more Americans out farming, starting farms, and feeding our communities.
What inspired you personally to make this movie? Do you have a relationship of your own with farming, food production, small town life?
Well, I don't. I am one of the new generation of people who's super idealistic and perhaps a little naive and excited about this local food movement. With that said, I do eat three times a day, sometimes more. And so for me, this film actually came out of a lot of screenings that we did at the first film I directed, which is called Rare Meat. And I met Garrett at a screening that we did at Truman State University. And all these people, we would have local food together beforehand, and then we'd have the screening and then a panel conversation with farmers. And all these people were coming up to me after the screenings and saying, we really need young people to start farming. And so that was really where this film came from, was through people in rural America and urban America, suburban America, saying at these events that the most important thing we can do as a nation for agriculture is get young people into farming.
So, I mean, I feel like you just started answering this, but how did you go about finding the farmers whose stories you ended up telling?
Well, a lot of it was through these screening events with the first film I directed, American Meat. And so we did a wonderful screening at Truman State University, and Garrett came up to me afterwards and said, I've been going through the classifieds day after day, and I can't find any land, and I can't get land. And I think he was probably 22, 23 at this time. This would have been 6 or 7 years ago. And I immediately was like, that is an important story. And so I got in touch, got Garrett's contact information, and started filming with him. And yeah, this is a film which we cover many stories all across the country, and a lot of those characters that are in the film, a lot of these people that are in the film, I met at screenings, or people at screenings said, hey, like, this is a young person doing something interesting. And one thing I'd like to mention is that this film is largely about solutions. We tell a lot of stories that some of the challenges that young farmers face, but more than the challenges, we're talking about the solutions. So a lot of ways that young people can get started. This is an optimistic film.
Well, we're going to get to some of those shortly, but I do want to establish some of the complexity of the problem first with you, because you do lay out the problem early on in the film. I mean, part of it is that the cost of farming has become prohibitive, or it seems to be. Can you talk to me about that? What has made farming expensive?
Well, we've gotten into this situation where the only way that farms can stay in business is by buying up their neighbor's land. And the reason for that is because farmers are getting squeezed from both sides. They have to pay retail prices for their equipment, for their feed, for their fertilizer, for their antibiotics, and then they have to sell at wholesale prices. And what that means is that farmers, basically, the only way they have razor-thin margins and the only way that they can continue to survive as a farm is to buy up more and more acreage. And concurrently, we've had great technological leaps, and we have a situation in which a combine, which 40 years ago would have been, $30,000 to $40,000, is now $500,000. And so basically we're in a situation in which it's impossible for a young person to get in unless they're born into it, because if you need to suddenly get 1,000 acres of land and that land is going to be costing $10,000 an acre, there's absolutely no bank that would give a loan to a young person. And that's not even enough. You would need the equipment, you need the seed. So we've created a situation which old farmers can't get out of it and young farmers can't get into it. And
what?
So that's where we're at today. Yeah, 6% of America's farmers are under the age of 35. 6%. That's a really low number.
Why is the land so expensive? I mean, in Missouri, you explain a sort of political component of that having to do with a law that passed fairly quietly in the state.
Yeah, it is a really, really somewhat of a eye-opening story, which was that Shuang Wei purchased Smithfield, which is America's largest producer of pork. And then Smithfield paid a number of representatives that changed the law that was passed that said that foreign countries and foreign-owned companies cannot own Missouri farmland. And so they changed that law so that way Shuang Wei could own over 40,000 acres
and Shuang Wei
of farmland in Missouri. Shuang Wei is a large multinational pork company that is owned by the Chinese government, or at least certainly very much in ties with the Chinese government.
So that's part of what makes it hard for a guy like Garrett to buy the land.
So you've got, exactly. Garrett's 25 years old. He's, doesn't have a lot of money, and he's looking to start his dream farm. And you've got a situation in which he's got retired lawyers and retired doctors who are trying to buy up, their sort of retirement home in Weston. And then you've got a few miles away, Shuang Wei has purchased up thousands and thousands of acres. So there's pretty much no way that Garrett's going to be able to get that land when he's competing with both folks who are retiring and also transnational corporations who are looking to gobble up as much land as possible.
Well, we're going to talk to Garrett in just a second, but I do want to say Weston is pretty interesting to me. I mean, you were talking about retirees buying up land. I worked on the same farm that Garrett was working on for a little while, Green Dirt Farm, and one of my coworkers there was from Weston. She was a teenager, and she was just, you know, a young girl who helped out with chores. And one day we were listening to public radio in the barn and a story about gentrification came on. And she was like, what does gentrification mean? And when I explained it, she was like, oh, that's happening here. And she offered me the evidence of paving gravel and dirt roads. And she was like, farmers don't need that. It's for rich people who want to come here. Can you talk to me about that?
Absolutely. I mean, you bring up a really great point, which is that there's all of these challenges I mentioned earlier about how farmers need to buy more and more land. And that's in a place, those are in the more rural areas. Now, in the areas like Weston that are closer to a metropolitan area like Kansas City, the challenge is actually that land is becoming so valuable for real estate. And so you have a situation in which the property taxes go up and the taxes for owning that land in a place that's becoming more and more valuable or gentrified, as you point out, becomes impossible for the farmers to keep their farm. And the only way they can sort of maintain any type of financial stability is to actually sell the farm. And so we have this really, really nasty situation for farmers now where they either have to buy the land if they're in a really rural area or they have to sell the land if they're near a city. And it's just super hard for farm families to keep it going.
Well, let's talk to Garrett. He is the postal worker who used to be a farmer, who still hopes to be a farmer. And we heard his story a little bit earlier in the show. We're going to talk with him now. He's taking a break from his mail route to call in. Hi, Garrett.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So thank you for taking the time. First of all, tell me more about your vision for a pig farm, this vision that you got so close to making a reality.
Absolutely. When I grew up as a kid in Carrollton, Missouri, I grew up on a farm. We had pigs. My dad, I helped him out. And it was just really inspirational to be able to work on a farm. I enjoyed it more than anything. Working with my dad side by side, it was definitely something I wanted to do later in life and do something with my kids.
You had taken some notes in a journal that were shared in the documentary, notes about, you know, your model, what the model for your pig farm was going to be.
Sure, absolutely. And what I was looking to do is something that wasn't completely invested in just farming. Being a postal worker, it was something that would help me finance a farm. So I would have some, I wouldn't put all the risk on the farm. So I'd put a pig model, basically, so I could part-time farm and still work at the post office.
Where does the dream stand now? Are you still investigating the possibilities?
Yes, ma'am. I'm saving money, talking with people in the community, still talking to farmers. And like I said, we're getting closer all the time.
One of the stats in the documentary, and one that we've heard already a couple of times today, is that the average age of the American farmer is 60. So the future of farming is going to require a new batch of farmers ready to take over. When you think about just big picture, what is standing in the way of young people like you who want to do that? What would you share with our listeners?
Well, I just want to mention that actually today's my dad's birthday. He's 67, and he still farms full time. So he kind of represents what's going on right now. For young people, it's a lot of the cost, and that's a big hurdle to get past. It takes patient persistence. That's what I like to say.
What do you think, if you could imagine a change that is in the power of either ordinary people or politicians or older farmers, if there's someone out there who could do something that would make this path I don't know, more accessible to you, what would it be?
That's a good question. And I think there's still a lot of things that need to be figured out before I can find the answers. There's a lot of young people that are interested in farming, but have been so detached from it that they don't know where to get started.
As in, they grew up with a lifestyle that wasn't doing the chores and all those things you've got to do?
Absolutely.
Does that describe a lot of the people you met at Truman State?
Yes, it does. They were kids that grew up in suburban areas around Kansas City, St. Louis areas, and they had a big interest in agriculture, but weren't familiar with the operations of it.
You know, I want to let you get back to your mail route in just a second, but I'm curious, there's a scene in this movie where you are looking out at the land that might have been your farm if it cost a little less, and you're talking about the possibility that they're going to tear down the barn, that it's not going to be a farm at all for the new owners. And there, I can tell that that is a powerful moment for you. Can you talk to me about what you were feeling?
Yeah, I really had become attached to that property. It was kind of diamond in the rough, and which made it seem like I had a better shot. I had a great relationship with the family. So I had high hopes that I could buy a piece of land and get started.
Well,
and it was just a disappointment when that couldn't happen.
Yeah, and you had to watch it all happen from right across the street.
Right.
Well, Garrett, I really hope that you find a way to make your dream come true, and yeah, I really appreciate your taking the time with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It'll come true. It just takes patience and persistence.
Thank you so much, and I hope that's true. Graham Merriweather, you are the maker of this film where we discovered Garrett's story through you. Can you chime in here? I mean, this is part of a larger story to you.
Absolutely. You know, and as I listen to Garrett, I'm really moved because he represents really the best of what America is, which is people that are willing to do the work that's foundational to our culture. And I think a lot of times we don't really reflect on the fact that without farmers, none of the other jobs that we have would even be possible. And so to me, whether or not we're able to make is up to us as a culture and up to us as a community. So if we can't do that, we've failed. And if we can, we've succeeded.
Well, Graham, hang on with me. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to pick right back up with this conversation in just a minute. Our next guest is a farmer in Edgerton, Kansas. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about a new documentary called Farmers for America. There will be a screening at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City on August 18th. And after the movie, Garrett Greider, the young guy we just heard from, will join our next guest in a panel discussion about the challenges facing young farmers today. So let's hear from our next guest, Claire Zimmerman of Groundspeak Farm in Edgerton. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Like Garrett, you studied farming at Truman State, but your path has been different from his. Can you tell the story of your career in farming so far?
Absolutely. Garrett and I did go to college together, so it was wonderful to hear him on the radio just a moment ago. After college, I really dove into agriculture. I was one of the students who went to Truman from the suburbs. I grew up in Overland Park, Kansas. Got really into sustainable farming, sustainable farm practices, and farm management.
Got into those things how?
In college, I was really interested in plant systems, animal systems, the way that our farms were operating currently, and how we could manage farms in a more sustainable way, and really got into the local food movement, the quality of food that local farms were producing, And I wanted to be a part of that that network.
As someone who grew up in the suburbs not doing this, did you feel daunted at all? Like there was some sort of like initiation process you needed to go through, or did that not cross your mind?
I don't think it crossed my mind so much. I was so eager and excited to be on the farm, on the campus, participating with other students who had farming experience, didn't have farming experience, just getting our boots on the ground, so to speak.
Can you tell me the story of the first time you did get your boots on the ground?
Oh, goodness. It probably would have been orientation week of at Truman State University, getting out to the campus farm. We had a 400-acre farm, livestock, horses, row crops. There was specialty crops and vegetables growing out there as well. So just kind of the seeing all these different components operating on one farm, seeing the community of students out there, understanding how much the professor cared about what was happening on that farm and the education they were doing with the students was just wonderful to be a part of.
Was seeing a farm in operation what you had imagined in your mind, or did you realize that there had been some disconnects?
I didn't come in with expectations of what I wanted to see a farm look like. My mom grew up on a farm in central Kansas, and we have farming roots, so I'd been exposed to, you know, large farms growing up. Didn't grow up on a farm. But I, you know, I didn't really have any expectations. I thought I wanted to be a vet, so I knew that I could get my prerequisites through a agricultural science route. I wanted to be outside. I loved food, so I chose to pursue agricultural sciences and saw where it would take me.
So what are some of the things you've done since graduation?
Since graduation, I've had the opportunity to work at Powell Gardens and experience working with a lot of different vegetable crops in the Heartland Harvest Garden. I managed a loose leaf lettuce vegetable farm in Colorado. That was an organic startup farm. And then I have worked in Kansas City at organizations such as Cultivate Kansas City, working with local farmers, and at Johnson County Community College as well, helping to educate students of all different backgrounds.
People like you.
People like me. Yep, people not like me.
But you have started your own thing, Groundspeak Farm?
Yep, so that's been something that I've been very fortunate to have kind of found an opportunity and a way to start my own farm business. So I think that the community and the networks I've established through having kind of some professional experience in the local food movement has given me a lot of alternative options that maybe not all young farmers have had or have been exposed to.
Tell me about those options. What was it that made it possible for you to start Groundspeak Farm? And tell me a little bit about the business model.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a 2-acre specialty crop production farm, and I'm operating organically. I have organic practices. I'm not certified through the USDA. I sell at the Overland Park Farmers Market, and I'm also a grower member for Rolling Prairie CSA. So through my various jobs I've had in the local food movement in Kansas City, I've become well-connected with other farmers. I've seen a lot of different farm models. I've had the opportunity to meet with a lot of different market managers about people who are well-connected and are really passionate about the local food movement here in Kansas City. So the opportunities that that has provided me has been kind of a resiliency in terms of having a community and a network behind me to support me as a young farmer, that I think that, you know, if you're just coming in, you haven't had prior experience or prior connections in the local food movement, you might not be as aware of some of the opportunities for markets or land access or funding sources that are available for beginning farmers.
Okay, talk to me about the land access, because that has been Garrett's real hang-up. Tell me about the land you farm.
Yeah, so I farm in Edgerton, Kansas. It's a farm that's been owned by the same family for 6 generations. The landowner on that particular piece of property has a strong interest in sustainable agriculture and the production of healthy food for the local community. So through the local food agricultural networks here in Kansas City, a message was sent out and broadcast through different listservs and email groups for different local organizations. And I was fortunate enough to come across that. And he was looking for a farmer to help transition his farm to a more sustainable kind of holistic model of agriculture.
Okay, the crucial thing I feel like you've just said here is that you were on a listserv that told you, that let you know about this guy and what he wanted to do, and so that there was land that someone felt passionate about providing to someone with the right mission, with the right philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's absolutely correct. So there's a lot of organizations in Kansas City that I know young farmers would benefit greatly by being associated with, by finding kind of a community of people at the same growth stage, at different growth stage, have people, apprentice at other farms or join these communities of young farmers.
And then the other thing you said that this network has provided you is knowledge of funding sources for young farmers. That seems like it would also help Garrett a whole lot.
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of alternative sources for funding, and sometimes it works for young farmers, sometimes it doesn't, depending on what type of funding they're looking for. So whether it's through assistance with navigating getting loans through the FSA, Farm Service Agency, for kind of some of the more specialty crops or alternative crop production farm models, that can be a challenge or an opportunity. There's opportunities through the Natural Resource Conservation Service, also through the USDA, to help get some infrastructure for farms.
I'm curious what hit home for you when you saw this movie, Farmers for America. Were you moved by other people's stories?
Oh, absolutely. Every farmer has such a unique story of what brought them in, what they care about, what they're looking to kind of nurture and develop and grow on their farm, what type of legacy they'd like to leave for the next generation of farmers. So I think that the new generation of farmers coming in, and it's been said over and over again, we need a lot more people. We need a lot more young people who have the passion and motivation to get into this. They're really setting the path for what inspires the next generation of farmers. And there's a lot of really good intentions and passionate people out there.
Graham Merriweather, I want you to come back in and talk to me about what you're hearing and the difference between Claire Zimmerman's story. She has her own farm, and Garrett Greider's story. He's had to put those dreams of his own on hold.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly really inspiring to listen to both Garrett and Claire. And clearly, Claire has been able to take advantage of some really awesome resources that are out there. And, I mean, one of the things that I think is more and more apparent as I talk to farmers all across the country and food advocates across the country is that we're all very much interconnected, and that the way that we're going to move together forward is by sharing resources, by sharing ideas, by sitting down and having breakfast together and having a good conversation, by talking to an old farm family that's looking for a transition and figuring out where there's a synergy between your life's dream and the dream of the family farm. And I think that there is no one path that is superior to another. We all are on our own unique paths. And certainly I believe very much that Claire's farm is a wonderful success story. And I believe very much that Garrett will successfully start his dream farm, and that the both of them will feed the Kansas City community for many years to come.
In your movie, there's this really powerful kind of idea that runs throughout it, that farming is the foundation of any culture. And you've used music and photography and everything to impart a really dramatic kind of dignity and importance to the work in the rural landscape. Can you talk to me about that? Just the eyes that you look at this landscape with and the feeling that you bring to the stories you're telling.
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, I'm very much not from a rural background. And so for me, I've been on a journey since 2007, which is when I started filming for the first film I directed, which is also about farming and agriculture, in which I've gotten to know rural America very intimately. I've slept on the couches and spare bedrooms of the farmers I filmed with. I've eaten at the dinner table. I've bowed my head in prayer with them. I've gotten to also experience the great joy, the beautiful harvest days when the sun and the sky and you're outside. I've also seen the pain, but on the main streets where the hardware store shut down, the beauty parlor, and the only thing left is a post office and a grain elevator. And so I guess you could say that over the last 10 years or so, I've kind of fallen in love with rural America and our nation. And I think that really cities are wonderful places, and I've had the privilege to live in cities. And I think the people who live in cities should have a deep gratitude for people in rural areas, because cities are actually built on the backs of the farmers and farm workers in rural America. Every day those trucks, they drive into the city with the food, and it's because of the work of farm families that food is on those trucks.
Well, Graham Merriweather, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
And Claire Zimmerman, thank you.
Thank you.
You can see Farmers of America, that documentary, at All Souls in Midtown this weekend. The event is being hosted by Kansas Public Radio. I'm Gina Kaufman, and coming up, we'll hear about a new classical album by a local composer inspired by fragments of poems. That's next. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm joined by Ingrid Stolzel, a composer who teaches at KU. Her classical compositions have been performed in concert halls all over the world, and she's just released a new album. In case you think classical music is this hard-to-get genre that you have to be trained to appreciate, just hold up, because Ingrid's goal as a composer is actually not some complex idea just for classically trained audiences. Her goal is goosebumps. Ingrid, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to me about goosebumps.
Well, it's such an amazing thing we can experience when we're listening to music. It's just a physical reaction to what we're experiencing. And I remember it as a child so vividly. Just even right now, I can think of a piece of music and make myself get goosebumps. And it's a phenomenal thing.
I want to talk to you about your new album and play some clips for our listeners. But first, I do want to talk about you. Did you grow up in a musical family?
I did. I grew up in Germany, and my father was a singer. We had a music room in the house, and so I started playing an instrument early on and just was surrounded
by
music.
What instrument?
I played piano. Yeah.
That seems like a natural start for a composer, maybe because it's melodic.
It is. It's actually all of it. It's melodic. It's harmonic. It has the range of an orchestra. So to this day, I compose at the piano.
When did you start writing music?
I started writing music as a kid, but, you know, I didn't call myself a composer. It was just something that I did for fun.
An unusual child.
Right. I mean, there are some, probably. But for me, it was always difficult to memorize other people's music. And, you know, when you learn piano, you learn Mozart and Haydn and all of those composers. And I would always sort of improvise different endings to pieces just because I wasn't very good at memorizing other people's music.
What was the impulse? Can you describe the impulse to just make up your own ending?
I think there was something just creative about it. And sometimes the music, I felt like, not that I think I'm better than Mozart, but I wanted it to go somewhere else. And so I let myself just almost like just improvise at the piano. And that's still a way for me to find inspiration today. Just let myself kind of be inside the sound world and see where it wants to go.
And like your fingers just nowhere to go on the keyboard?
Yeah, although I should say, you know, I'm not a pianist anymore because I just spend more time composing than I do playing the piano.
Your new album is actually your first commercial album, and it's called The Gorgeous Nothings. The first few songs are inspired by, do I understand this right, scraps of paper that Emily Dickinson left behind?
Yeah, so there's an amazing book out, a facsimile edition called The Gorgeous Nothings, and it's envelope writings. She, at times, she just grabbed whatever she could find, and often it was envelopes. And she would write down thoughts. They're not really completed poems per se, they're fragments. And really, it was quite inspiring also looking at the poems and her handwriting. And often she would have multiple words that she hadn't decided which one she was going to go for. And so that really helped me in my creative process as well.
What did you like about that? I mean, was it the idea of just getting inside someone else's creative process?
Absolutely. Because if you look at my sketches and my notes that I put on staff paper, I cross things out. I write different variations on something. I often have 10 different endings to a piece of music. And so it gives somebody a little bit of insight of what, you know, what was going on for Emily Dickinson. And it gave me, I think, a bit more freedom in interpreting her words. Because these are not published poems. They're fragments.
We talked a while back about what it's like to be a woman in classical music today, specifically a composer creating new works in that arena. And I wonder if some of the challenges, but also triumphs you've had in that world, connect you in a weird way to this 19th century female poet, the experience of being a woman with something to say, with an impulse for creative expression.
Absolutely. And I think Emily Dickinson is, her words today to me are so contemporary. It doesn't feel like I'm reading something that was written, you know, 100 years ago. And to me, that is, I think, ultimately the goal of great art, is that it really surpasses our own time, that we can read something or listen to something and it still makes sense.
Let's listen to some of this music. We're going to start with a short one called In This Short Life. What's the Emily Dickinson envelope or scrap that inspired this one?
Yeah, this is actually, she wrote this very short fragment on the flap of an envelope. And I'll let the singer tell you the words, but the shape of it, and it just felt really urgent and also very concise. So I also, in my
What felt urgent about it? Was it the handwriting or something?
The handwriting, and also, you know, just, it felt like she grabbed this little flap of an envelope and couldn't wait to get to her notebook. It had to be written down at that moment.
All right, here is In This Short Life. Tell me about that song, Ingrid.
Wow, I just love her words. In this short life that only lasts an hour, how much, how little is within our power. And she actually gives two words in the beginning. She kind of has them written on the envelope flap above each other. It's only and merely. I know they're synonyms, really, but I decided to use them both. So I repeat that first line twice. And I just, it's, the words are powerful, and I wanted to also have a very concise, short song that kind of expresses that. And this, you heard I would believe many of your listeners know this voice, Sarah Tannehill Anderson, one of our wonderful Kansas City sopranos, and she just so captures that with her voice.
What is it about those lines about how little is within our power that resonates with you?
Yeah, so I said those words sort of reflectively at the end. So it has this big moment, how much, how little, and then is within our power. To me, it's really that we don't have any power, and we should, you know, be in the moment and enjoy that hour that we have.
Tell me about your process. Do you have like a routine or set of rituals that allow you to immerse yourself in this, what you called a world of sound, but it's also a world of language?
It is. And I, on this CD, I have two song cycles, and those are, of course, you know, the words are the most important, and I immerse myself in those words. But even the other pieces, the other chamber pieces, start really with a title and an emotional sound world I'm trying to create. And that is what really kind of every day I get to enter that sound world. It's like a best friend, honestly. When I'm working on a piece of music, it's like coming home and getting to be with a best friend for a while.
We're going to hear another song now. This one is based on Walt Whitman. So first of all, why Walt Whitman?
Yeah, so I'm sure many Americans come across Walt Whitman much earlier in their lives, maybe even high school, I don't know. But for me, because I grew up in Germany, I read Rilke and Goethe, and so I come to these American greats like Dickinson and Whitman much later in life. And I read Leaves of Grass, which is just mind-blowingly amazing. And I picked three poems to create a song cycle, which I call Soul Journey 3.
But before we talk about your songs, I am so curious about someone with a German background who's coming to Walt Whitman as an adult, and as an adult living in America. What spoke to you?
I think, again, it's these contemporary ideas that we, you know, that life's a journey, and that we really need to be in the moment. And when I write music, I feel like music has that ability to move us to really, sometimes we lose track of time when we listen to music. It's really quite extraordinary.
So this song is called I Swear I Think. What is the original poem or line that inspired it?
Yeah, so this is from Leaves of Grass, and this is the second song in the cycle. And when I put a song cycle together, I try to create a larger narrative. So not each song is just its own thing, but that the three songs in the cycle create a journey. And the first song is sort of this, the poet realizing there is a thing that's grander than just what we see. And the second song, which you're going to play, I Swear I Think, it's quite joyful and playful, where the poet basically realizes, wow, everything has a soul. So he talks about the animals and the sea and the weeds, and so that everything is connected and alive. And yeah, so that's what I'm trying to capture in this playful song.
Well, here's Ingrid Stolzel's I Swear I Think.
I swear I think now that everything without exception has an eternal soul.
The trees have... So, yeah, this is very playful. The yeah. idea that what you're trying to capture here is the idea that everything has a soul.
Yeah, and he says, you know, Whitman says that there is nothing but immortality, that in some way, shape, or form, you know, everything continues as energy. And to me, that's a very contemporary way of thinking about life.
What is it about the sound of the song that captures that?
To me, it's a celebratory, uplifting kind of song, and the part that we're hearing right now is, yeah, playful. And when we, I think, go through life like that, thinking and looking at things as if they're all connected, we have a certain joy, I believe.
And you said this is part of a three-song cycle, and this is so first it's realizing that life is grander than it maybe seems on the surface, and then the next is realizing that everything is interconnected and that you can enjoy it.
Yeah.
What's third?
So third is the end of life, and this is written later in Whitman's life, and it's clear that he is older when he writes it, and yet, you know, it's in the same spirit where he feels there is, you know, the soul has been with us all along, and even though we go into this unknown now.
Classical music has this reputation for being stuffy or snobby. You might have heard this reputation before, but you seem to be actively working to change that perception. Do you find that to be an uphill battle?
Sometimes. And also, you know, programming, people generally program the known pieces. It's, you know, possibly a risk for them to program something new. But whenever I go to a contemporary art museum or like the MoMA in New York, there's lines out the door. People wanting to see contemporary art and things that are created in our time. I feel like it's the same with music. It speaks in a way to our time. And if we're lucky, it will transcend our time like many amazing pieces have done in the past. But for sure, music being written today has something to say about today, and that's important to me.
So for venues, there's the risk of putting on something that isn't recognizable to the audiences. How do you get the audiences to show up who aren't maybe part of that, you know, entrenched classical music world? Like maybe they would like this new sound you're presenting, but how do you let them know that?
Yeah, I go to a lot of concerts, and I find actually the personal touch of having the composer there. So it's not this just completely removed or dead white guy. You know, there's no connection anymore. When they meet a composer or audiences, and after the performance can come up and ask questions, I think it breaks down that barrier that it's, you know, something unapproachable.
The name of this album, Gorgeous Nothings, you've said I mean, I'm curious to hear you talk about what that means to you, Gorgeous Nothings.
Yeah, so you know, I stole it from Emily Dickinson, and it's in the first song of the Gorgeous Nothings. And for her, the way she thinks of those words together is that everything, like a sunset, the wheels of birds, you know, the seasons, all of that, these are things that happen all the time. They're nothings, but they're gorgeous, and they make up life. It's even though, you know, life has big moments that we might remember, it's the collection of little things that really makes a life.
What makes them nothing, though? I mean, I think maybe it's this, that all of the things you've described are really fleeting.
Yeah, perhaps. I think and the idea of impermanence, you know, that nothing really remains the same. I think throughout the album, I have a theme of that.
That could be such a somber idea, but for you, it seems to be uplifting and inspiring. Can you talk about where that just attitude comes from within your life, within your day-to-day approach to things?
Yeah, I mean, I have a meditative practice, and I think that certainly has influenced my writing. And I think my goal as a composer is to put love and joy out there. I'm aware of the things that are going on, of course, in the world, but what's most authentic to me is to put something out there that is uplifting, and that's how I also, you know, when you write a piece of music, you live in that world for a long time. So I'm sort of selfishly picking a joyful, peaceful, loving sound world for myself.
What would be the just biggest, most meaningful compliment you could possibly receive from a listener?
For me, it's that they were moved by something I've done. And if they're so willing to share that, I think that's really touching.
Ingrid Stolzel, congratulations on your first commercial album.
Thank you so much.
Ingrid is an associate producer. producer, professor of music composition at KU, and her new album is The Gorgeous Nothings. That's a wrap for today's show, but you can catch either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's where you can listen back to anything you might have missed or share the discussions with your friends. Earlier today, we spoke with young farmers from our area about the challenges and maybe little-known opportunities facing food producers in this country. kcur.org/centralstandard, and you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, UMKC has been considered a commuter school for a long time. Student life at that commuter school tomorrow at 10. Plus, as we look back at 10 years since the recession, we'll revisit some stories that we told 10 years ago. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.